Good evening, everyone. Welcome back to the second half of Interpreter Foundation Radio tonight. I'm Terry Hutchinson, and my co-host John Gee is with me. Good evening, John.
Good evening.
We are here to talk to you tonight on our second half of the broadcast, which is sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation Come Follow Me. Our segment will be the lesson that covers Exodus 1 through 6. But before we go there, we want to thank our sponsor for this segment of the program, which is LDSAgents.com. LDSAgents.com is a group of like-minded LDS agents who share your values, and they are all licensed real estate areas agents all around the United States and Canada. And if you are going to sell your home, if you're going to buy a home, and you're looking for somebody who can represent you and help you through that process, whether it's buying or selling, go to the LDS agent's website. They can direct you to somebody who can help you. That person will not only share your values, but will also know special needs about the neighborhoods. What are the best schools for your particular family needs? Maybe what are the best sports programs? What are the best neighborhoods for this? What's the closest commute? You know, sometimes they might even know where some of the places are that you might want to land and people you might want to associate with in a ward level. So it just depends. But I'm sure that people at that website will be able to help you, and they've been a sponsor of this program. We want to thank them once again, and we've talked about this before. The Interpreter Foundation has their fingers in a lot of pies, if you will. All of it's volunteer, except for a few of the paid staff to keep the website going and other things like that. But all of us who are doing the radio, or who do the articles, who put them together, those who do peer reviews, all the rest of that, it's all volunteer. And, and we are also very transparent. All the donations, the financial statements are on the website. So if you're concerned about anything, but all of your donations are to a 503C charitable foundation. It's tax deductible. So I encourage you to go check it out. And if you don't want to donate, that's fine. Just be a recipient. And there's nothing wrong with that. Just sign up for the journal on your internet, and every week you'll get at least one, and usually more than one, articles on various topics that support the teachings and doctrines of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And that's what the Interpreter Foundation is all about. And I have been waiting for this for a long time, because I love the Old Testament. And here I am with John Gee, and now we're going to talk about Israel and Egypt. Now, John.
Yes.
I'm going to embarrass myself a little here. I love Charlton Heston and the Ten Commandments. Well, that is my all-time favorite movie. So when I see Moses, that's who I see, even though I know the Scripture says otherwise.
It. Occasionally when live people are depicted by actors, they have their preference about who the actors are going to be. And Charlton Heston definitely made a heroic Moses.
Yeah. Why did he need Aaron?
Well,
he wasn't that slow of speech.
Not in the movie version, but definitely larger-than-life heroic. Hollywood was good at doing that back then. These days, I think they prefer anti-heroes, they want to see how flawed it is, and
we'll just leave it in the Marvel universe. Yeah,
wouldn't rate very highly on their list of flaws. They want them flawed in moral ways.
But I had a hard enough time with Lord of the Rings, what they did to that. But anyway,
yeah,
in the first part. And don't get me wrong, I like the movie, but
it's.
But we're going to stick with Exodus here.
I won't go
too far afield today.
All right. Well, Exodus. Now, Exodus is really interesting, and very interesting where the tale is so terse. Because some of this area if you're looking at Egyptian history, there are certain time periods which are more brilliantly lit as far as historical details than others. And the time period around the Exodus is one of those. That doesn't
where
mean
it's brilliantly lit or where it's kind of silent?
No, where it's brilliantly lit.
Okay.
But it's deceptive because we know a lot about some things and next to nothing about others. And because we know so much about certain areas of civilization at that time, we get the impression that we have a complete picture, and we don't. And one of the things that's interesting about the Exodus here is where it fits into that and into the Egyptian history. We have – this is a time period so where – we have lots of information about Egyptian foreign relations that we don't have didn't have before. We only have a fraction of that information.
But it's more than we have in other times.
No, more than we have, so much more than we have in other times that we think that we have far more material than we have. So one of the complaints that people come up is they say, well, we don't have any historical information for Israel in Egypt at the Exodus. Well, we don't have lots of historical information at that time. And because we know certain areas better, we have this, and because it's so much better attested than other time periods. So the time period of Joseph, we know next to nothing. By comparison, we know so much more about this time period that we think that we've got everything. But we neglect to realize that from the time period when Israel is in Egypt and they're in the Delta, we have one preserved papyrus from that time in the Delta, and it's illegible.
There's nothing.
We have that one papyrus and we can't read it. Mm-hmm. So it's so damaged that it's...
Well, Nahum Sarna said he did the commentary on Exodus for the Jewish Publication Society, but he also wrote a little book before that called Understanding Exodus. Actually, I think he wrote it after. Well, he did a second edition after. And he says one of the things about that is that the historians for the pharaohs loved to write about their victories.
And they never write about their defeats.
Not a single word.
Yes.
And this definitely would have come into that category. And then the other thing he says is, listen, you know, we're missing a lot of archaeological evidence about certain things. There's certain things that we can't find. We can't find archaeological evidence that they wandered in the desert for 40 years. There's just, you know, there's been no finds yet. He says, but about this time over in Canaan, over in Israel, all of a sudden, there are settlements popping up everywhere.
There are.
And he says, and it's possible to explain that to a certain degree by improved technology with plows or with cisterns or with other things in order to be able to feed all those people. But he said that still doesn't say where did those people come from.
Yeah.
And so there's some evidence there that's really low-key. That kind of flies under the radar, and I've been using that phrase a lot lately. I probably shouldn't reuse it the rest of the week. But then we have these others where there's an absence. And so there's still this tremendous argument, whether or not this really happened.
There is. And one of the things that's interesting to me about this particular issue is that one of the biggest the people who are big on there's no archaeological evidence for Israel and Egypt or for the Exodus are also tend not to be actual archaeologists. And so when you look at somebody like Manfred Bitok, who has been for decades one of the top archaeologists in
He's a guy actually out there getting his hands dirty.
Yes, and he is extremely good. you can make the case that he is the best archaeologist excavating in Egypt. There are others who will dispute that. So we safe to say that he is one of the best. So he is one of the best, and he has gone on record in both English and German for saying that there is archaeological evidence for Israel in Egypt before the Exodus. And so that's a fairly heavy weight to come in along on that side. And he's not the only one who gets their hands dirty in archaeology who says that. So you have James Hoffmeyer, who has books on Israel and Egypt and Israel and Sinai, both dealing with those.
Currently in a box at my house.
Currently on my shelf in my office.
I've been there.
So he also argues that there's archaeological evidence for that. You have so you do have people who are top names in the field who take those issues seriously and who can actually argue for the case that this actually did happen. The thing that we need to remember about this is that we need to remember where some of the holes in our evidence are. So we can't say that this didn't happen when it happens to happen in one of the big holes that we have. Another problem with say, archaeology in the Delta is that the Delta has a very high water table. And just like I used to live in an area in Utah County that also had a high water table, and you couldn't have a basement. And that's one of the problems they had to deal with when they put in the Provo City Center Temple is the water table is too high there for a normal basement, so they had to...
Yeah, surprisingly, you have that in St. George in a lot of places.
And
people think of it as a desert, but you go under the ground and you've got major water all over the place, including at the temple.
Right, so you have to... this is something that construction people know about and deal with. Well, this has two facets with archaeology. The first is that if you start digging, your holes are going to fill up with water. So the excavations often have to have pumps running 24 hours a day just to pump the water out. And it gets worse the lower down you go. And, of course, the lower down you go, then where people are more interested is precisely where it's more waterlogged. And the water also tends to destroy
your
certain
evidence.
Types of evidence, such as papyri. The other thing is Israelites were slaves. Well, all the records we have from the Delta that survive are on stone. Stone is expensive to carve. And so you putting the Pharaoh's victories, you don't put his defeats, you don't mention the slaves.
The Pharaohs like their images cut deep. That's a line from the movie, John. I know every line in that movie.
Yeah, well, that one is...
I'll try to calm
down.
If
you've been to Karnak, you can see that because Ramses II would literally sink
Okay, you're
going
to have to describe how far that is. You're holding up your hand.
It's about 8 inches.
There we go.
6 to 8 inches deep, where most of the glyphs around it are carved maybe half an inch. So they don't make stone monuments. They can't afford to. And they're not listed on stone monuments. You don't even get minor officials listed on stone monuments. If they are going to show up, they're going to show up on papyrus, but that doesn't survive.
Yeah.
So the problem is that it makes it very difficult to argue one way or the other simply because you have no evidence.
Right.
But just because you don't have evidence from the standard way to express it is absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
Right.
And so there are lots of different ways, different scenarios that might explain why you don't get evidence in that time. And it's because you've got multiple ones of them and you're dealing with a gap in your evidence. It's hard to argue that this one is preferable, is preferable in all way and logically to that one, because they're equal and logicalized. It's just that expresses a person's preference to either have or not have an exodus. So the idea that you don't have all of the that you don't have evidence for the exodus is a problematic argument. So you do have some, but it's also what sorts of things you would consider.
Well, the other thing to remember is that just like with Genesis, I mean, Martin and I a couple of weeks ago had Ben Spackman on, and he was talking about this with regard to Genesis, including the creation accounts. And that is, and I'm going to quote Sarna here, the overriding aim of the biblical writers was to present a theological or theocentric description of events. So they're intent on producing historiosity, not historiography. So they want to explain it in terms of the divine. So it's not a literal history. Yeah, so it just carries on. And you know, for me, it was kind of interesting because as we talked about when we were here a month ago, well, I was remote, but we were talking, you go from the creation and Adam and Eve and the fundamental foundational stories of humankind. You go through the flood. You go through the Tower of Babel. Then you get to Abraham, a family, and he and his descendants. And now you come to Joseph and his family, and then they go to Egypt, just one family. There's 70 of them. They pick up and leave Israel. They go to Egypt, and then they have this massive people over a 400-year period. But it still is the story of that family, the 12 tribes. And yet the story that's being told and the way it's being told is there's a mixture of symbolic, I guess you would say, and a mixture of literal. And it is meant to inspire.
Yeah, it's meant to inspire. It's also meant to convey things accurately. I remember going to some biblical scholars meetings where they were discussing this, and one of the presenters, whom I could name, but it doesn't really matter, argued that, well, is this, you know, you have to discount Exodus because there are these miraculous events and you don't have those in things like, well, he named the shipwrecked sailor. I teach the shipwrecked sailor. Yeah, you have a 70-foot giant snake who is described as like a god and acts like a god and foretells the future. And you want to talk about that as
literal,
as not miraculous?
That's an Egyptian story.
Yeah, it's okay. All of the Egyptian tales invoke the gods just as much as the Bible does. They're different gods. And this is the same as true if you go over into Mesopotamia. You sometimes can get away from the gods if you're looking at the bank books, but even then they'll pop up occasionally. The idea that and everybody then and part of the invitation now is that God does intervene in human lives and in history then and history now. Sometimes the problem is recognizing it. You know, Moroni tells you need to think about all the things that have happened to the children of men and how merciful God has been in preserving the children of men all the way down from history until the time you read this thing. It's not that he doesn't intervene. It's that we don't recognize his hand.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's Exodus makes that explicit in a number of of cases. And so the story here is interesting, and there are all these details that get dropped in that are reflective of an Egyptian milieu.
Yeah. So starting right at the first, the Pharaoh who knew not Joseph. We can go there.
Oh, yeah, we can go there. That's
so there was the 15th and 16th diagnosis, or is it the 7th, 16th and 17th?
Well, okay, it gets a little confusing. But
okay,
here's,
I'm going to shut up now.
Here's how it works. Middle Kingdom under the 12th dynasty falls apart and is replaced by the 13th dynasty in the south and the 14th dynasty in the north.
Okay.
Exactly when they start, the 14th dynasty, or the 14th dynasty in the north gets replaced by the 15th dynasty, who are called Hyksos. The 13th dynasty in the south gets replaced by the 16th and 17th dynasties,
okay,
mainly by the 17th dynasty, which then flows into the 18th dynasty, which is
Moses,
which kicks out the Hyksos.
Okay.
And
the Hyksos were the ones who came from the north.
Well, both the 14th and the 15th dynasty do come from the north. Only the 15th dynasty is actually called by the Egyptians Hyksos.
Okay.
So,
and that means
rulers of foreign countries.
Okay.
So it's complicated situation. So basically, Egypt is split. They've got about 200 years of that they've had a civil war. Joseph comes in at that time, sometime. We're a little bit sketchy. And then when the 18th dynasty takes over and drives out the Hyksos, they basically hack up everything that they have can get their hands on, which makes it really hard for us
to find anything.
To find anything. And they've been in the Delta, so that also makes it hard.
Mm-hmm.
Bitak has been excavating in the Delta, and so we know a lot more about their capital than we ever did before. But this figures
really
in into Exodus, where it says that the Israelites build Pithom and Ramses. And those are two known settlements. And basically what Ramses did is he took a part of Aras, which was the Hyksos capital, and this is 100 years later. He just quarried that and shipped all the stone down to build Pi-Ramses, his city. And then later, in Old Testament times, after the time of Solomon, the Egyptian pharaohs quarry Pi-Ramses and move it down to Tanis. But this is the pharaoh who knew not Joseph, and you could also translate it, didn't recognize Joseph. So he doesn't, mm-hmm. Those later pharaohs didn't consider them legitimate and did everything they could to destroy their memory. And if you're allied with them, the way the Israelites were, well, that's too bad for you.
Mm-hmm.
So you can...
The pharaohs that they were in with and had influence with are now gone. Those pharaohs' enemies have taken over and are erasing everything, and they're going to put the Israelites down under.
Right. I mean, it's... You can see it with some recent political things in the United States, but we don't go nearly to the extreme the Egyptians did.
Not yet, anyway.
And so that's part of it there. And then they talk about building those places and building them mainly out of mud brick. And so they would use stone for temples and maybe for palaces. But everything else in the place was built with mud brick.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a detail which is
well, there was
spot
an
on.
Estimate that I read that there was like 24 million bricks in, I can't remember which city it was. And yet there's evidence that it was hard for people to make bricks. I mean, a modern brickmaker can make the bricks about 3,000 a day, but in those days, not so much.
And depends on how they want the bricks. Do they want mm-hmm. the bricks with the king's name stamped in every brick? There are time periods when they do that.
But essentially, the powers that are there now who don't remember Joseph are putting the Israelites down, and they decide they're getting to be too powerful and too many of them, so they decide to kill their sons. The Pharaoh. We don't know.
Well, that's not something that they tend to mention in their records a lot.
The Egyptians?
Anybody.
Well,
only in Carthage do they talk about, yeah, this is a great thing, I killed my kid, or somebody else's kid. That's unusual to find that. Particularly in ancient Egypt, when the mortality rate is so high anyway. From what we do know, approximately one in every three children born didn't make it to their first birthday. That's a fairly sobering statistic.
Mm-hmm.
If you just think about your kids and you're going to give up every third one of them, which one?
Depends on the
give?
Day. Depends on the day.
So
I know I'll be struck for that. But
well, this is one of the things, and so they have to contrive a way to rescue Moses, which they do, and then and Moses gets in trouble and flees, and this is so standard in that time period when, actually, and for hundreds of years, both before and after it, is that they would go into exile. And if you look at international treaties, if they don't mention anything else that they're doing treaties, the main thing they want is extradition of fugitives. Because you get all kinds of problems when some royal prince falls out of favor, runs away to save his life,
then
sets
comes
up shop
with an army.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this, and Egyptians have stories about that. So
well, so do others. I was reading about how supposedly Moses' early life parallels the story of Sargon.
Sargon and also of, I think it's Cyrus.
Yeah. Cyrus is a Persian and Sargon was Assyrian, wasn't he?
Sargon the Akkadian is. Okay. He's pre-Assyrian.
Oh, okay.
So but you also see it in treaties that are. So the Hittites set up a treaty, and one of the first things that they list is, if there are any fugitives, you have to send them back.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what happened to Sennacherib when he kills, or when Artamulisi kills his father Sennacherib. He ends up fleeing to someplace out of extradition zone for the Assyrians. But one of the things that's happened, an indication of the dating in the text, is that at the end of the 18th dynasty, the Egyptian empire, which had stretched all the way up, well, Tutmosis had made it across the Euphrates for at least a raid, but didn't stay there. But they'd had an empire that stretched up to the Euphrates at one point, and that collapses. And so Moses doesn't have to flee very far. He just has to go to Midian.
That's on the Sinai Peninsula?
Around that area, sort of the Negev, South Israel,
okay.
and up into Sinai.
So the north part of that area.
Right, that's where they're usually placed.
Farther east.
Right.
Okay.
So he's able to get out of the out of the way of the pharaohs, and the pharaohs don't really have much of an empire. This is right around the time it collapses, which is one of the things that actually allows the Old Testament to take place, is that the over 100-year time period that empire that the Egypt had crumbles.
So there's a vacuum of power, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, usually what the first thing when Egypt was united is they'd go grab the area of modern-day Israel and up into Lebanon as a buffer zone. But they slip into a time period starting at about 1,000 or so where they've got a civil war in Egypt. And it's not unified, and they have one expedition that goes up there in Solomon's day. But that's it. And they can't control that area the way they used to. And so it's interesting. One of the things that comes up in sort of between the lines is that the Hittites end up making a treaty about this time with the Egyptians. And they'd been at odds, and there's a plague in among the Hittites, and they think it's caused because they reneged on their treaty with the Egyptians. But there are all kinds of reasons. But one of the other things is it doesn't look like they're able to hold that territory. And this is the territory in which Israel comes in after the Exodus. Well, Moses goes off into live with the Midianites and is offered the daughter's hand in marriage. He gets married and becomes a shepherd, which is for most people a step down. But at least he's still alive. And then he runs into this
burning bush. Well, and that was, you know, we were talking, you've written and spoken on this at one of the Interpreter Temple conferences.
Yes.
Tell us a little about that. That one is at press, I understand, and hopefully will be out in the next few months.
I don't know.
I said so, hopefully.
But he's told to take off his shoes from off his feet for the place where he stands is holy ground. And around this time in the temples, you have this phenomenon where some of the scenes the king is shown wearing sandals, and some of them he's shown not wearing sandals. And in some cases, they've actually erased the sandals that were on the feet. There seems to be a protocol about which scenes and which places in the temple
have sandals and
which
they
ones don't. And so I went through all of those scenes in one of the temples, and there are, if I remember right, somewhere in the neighborhood of 450 of the scenes. So it was a lot to go through and a lot to categorize. But basically, and certain of the scenes were inconsistent, so you had to figure out how to deal with were there more of them that showed one way or the other. But basically, when the king is shown doing things outside the temple, riding in his chariot, in battle, taking care of his horses, he's shown wearing sandals, which would particularly make sense if you're taking care of the horses. And in areas of the temple, he's shown barefoot. Again, there's some inconsistencies there, but you have enough that you can show some general patterns. And when he's involved in the sacred things and on sacred ground, he tends to be barefoot. And so it mirrors this statement about when you're on holy ground, you need to remove the shoes from your feet. And this is, of course, repeated again with Joshua. Where he's told in, I think at the end of chapter 2 in Joshua, to take his shoes off his feet because he's on holy ground. The idea is that you have different dress standards on holy ground. I don't know that I want to get into examining pharaonic kilts. I wish somebody would, but I don't want to do that. And that what you wear...
Tell Carrie to do it.
Assign it to a student, right?
There you go. Exactly. Hey, this will make a good master's thesis right here.
That's what I tell my students is which ones... Yeah, this is a good master's thesis. This is a good dissertation project.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's one of the things that the manual talks about. What they want us to focus on in this lesson in particular is showing reverence for holy things and places. And this is one of the first, I think, really that struck me as a young man. Okay. Obviously, we have the Lord talking. They call it the angel of the Lord or the angel of the Lord's presence. But yeah, in my mind, it's really the Lord. And he says his name. He gives Moses his divine commission. And, you know, that is just such a sacred experience, Moses entering his presence and to a certain degree being transformed. And I know there's a lot more about that that comes out.
You'd think we would, of all people, be attuned to that, since there are certain places where your dress and comportment is expected to meet certain standards.
Well, and then it changes literally.
In some places, yes.
It changes.
So if you're going to church, you're going to the temple, then you're expected to dress a certain way. And I remember running into a friend in one of the temples, and he was the engineer for the temple, dressed in white overalls. I have no idea where you find white overalls. But he was there to make sure all the light bulbs were working and bumped into him, and that was his job. But there he was in overalls, which would be appropriate for an engineer, but all in white, which mm-hmm. is appropriate for the temple. And that sort of how you dress and comport yourself makes a difference and shows your respect for the place. And Moses is clearly invited to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know. It's an imperative verb.
Well, so I look at that and I think, yeah, well, I think a lot of us do that, say, with our temple clothing or certain other, you know, elements about the temple. But I remember reading a passage about scriptures and how a Jewish person was invited to go to one of our seminaries, and the kids had, you know, their scriptures all piled around or on the floor or wherever. And he asked about that because those are our sacred things. And you know, he holds the Torah and the sacred books in a different way maybe than we do. And ever since I read that, look, it's not written down anywhere. It's not anything. But I have always tried with my printed scriptures to not to treat them better as a result.
Right. I remember I've run into more than one Jewish convert who really had a hard time with the way that some of us treat the scriptures because mm-hmm. he brought that, well, I'm thinking one in particular, but brought that in with him and is converted, is that this is sacred. You treat it sacred. You
it elevates it.
Yeah.
And frankly, I think it should be.
And he, to the extent where one copy that had been used a bit and you could tell that the cover was fraying and so forth from use, that wasn't replaced and seemed to an affront to him to.
Everybody handles it different, but it's like me. I have a really hard time. I won't say can't, but I have a very hard time disposing of an old edition of the Book of Mormon.
Yeah.
No matter how many kids have written on it, no matter how marked up it is, how torn the cover is or anything. And yet I remember the movie that came out about a long time ago about the Italian convert from Sicily who found the book.
How Rare a Possession.
How Rare a Possession, that's right.
I know one of the actors in there.
Uh-huh.
Actually, my voice is in that movie.
Really?
Yeah. They drag a bunch of us down from the Hebrew house to supply some of the Hebrew in one spot in there. And you don't get a full phrase from any mm-hmm. of us, but I know it's like, that's so-and-so, that's so-and-so. Oh, wait a minute, that's me. I love that movie.
That movie is one of my favorites. And you know, the cover's torn off, yet it's the content. Once again, that spiritual text we talked about in the first hour
that
has the power, but the physical presence of it. So you can take it to extremes. I don't want to kiss it every time I put it down. I don't want to keep it in a separate box. But on the other hand, I don't want to throw it around. I have trouble. I worry about disposing of it in a proper and respectful way.
Well, I think also you talk about that for treatment of sacred places as well as things or the story that when President Kimball went down to São Paulo to dedicate the temple and visited a chapel and saw some litter or something on the floor and bent down and picked it up, and the Brazilian saints observed that, and I was told for at least years afterwards. It may still be the case. I don't know. I've never been to Brazil, but they said they feel it's a sacred duty to keep the meeting house spotless. And since that treating the way they treat the sacred, and you get that. And that brings up another thing that shows up here in chapter 3 in Exodus is the way they treat the name of the Lord. Mm-hmm. And Jews are very particular on this, but so are Egyptians. Is that you don't mention the name of deity inappropriately. It's not a swear word. It's not something you use to vent your anger. This is something sacred and should be treated sacredly.
Mm-hmm.
When it's appropriate, you use it. I don't know that we go quite to the extent of not ever pronouncing it or putting a dash instead
of
others
do that. I got a book last year on the Tanakh, and they have a dash. They have a capital G, a dash, and a D.
Yeah.
To me, that's a little overkill. But on the other hand,
But they treat it with respect, and so it needs to be used properly and appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we may not want to draw the distinctions more than that, but it should be done in a proper and appropriate manner, and not. Not used casually or inappropriately.
Yeah. I mean, he uses an interesting phrase here that when he talks about that, he says, the Lord God of your fathers, this is in verse 15 of chapter 3, the Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, hath sent me unto you. This is my name forever. And this is my memorial unto all generations. Now, we use memorial, I think, in a different sense.
Yeah.
I mean, because it sends us over to Hosea.
Well,
and it says, even the Lord God of hosts, the Lord is his memorial. But a memorial to us is like a tombstone or a statue.
But the word here is zikri, and it's my remembrance.
Yeah.
And so
to me, it seems more like it's a verb.
Well, and so all through the Old Testament, there's a nice book called Zakor that discusses this, but it's also been brought into Latter-day Saint. Gary Novak and Lou Midgley did some work on this based on it, where they talk about the importance of remembrance and that remembering something is more than just a vague recall. And so one of the things that we do when we take the sacrament each Sunday is we remember him, both witnessing that we remember him at other times, but that we specifically remember him by taking the sacrament and remembering what Jesus has done for us. That's part of the remembrance. And that has worked its way into the church historical department, where they talk about the importance of remembrance and that the job of the church historian's office is to bring things to sacred things to remembrance. And so this is my remembrance forever. Mm-hmm. This is my name. When you use it, you need to remember God and remember the things that he has done for your fathers and for you. So that's just something that fits in with that. There are other things that are translated memorial, different words. But this is something to remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Specifically to remember.
And there's another one that I really appreciated, and I want to say it. There's a link that goes to the Book of Moses, where in the Book of Moses, the Lord talks about telling Moses more than this at the burning bush.
Yes.
And that... I was just looking for the reference and just couldn't put my finger on it at the moment, but you know what I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about. It shows up in Moses chapter 1, and he's shown a number of things, and this actually pops up in an Egyptian text, believe it or not. So there's this Egyptian text where they say that, let's see if I can remember the wording on this. Where they want God to reveal themselves to the individual the way that he revealed himself to Moses on the mountain where he created darkness and light. Which is reflected in the Book of Moses, but I'm not aware of anywhere else where that's reflected. Mm-hmm. And then it shows up in this Egyptian text.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's, you don't normally expect to find Moses in the Egyptian text, but there he is.
Same as Abraham every now and again, right?
Yeah. Well, I actually found this when I was looking at some of the Abraham ones, mm-hmm. but they, at least in later times, had some remembrance of Moses.
Well,
and a positive one,
uh-huh.
Oddly enough.
I mean, this section that we're talking about, chapters 1 through 6, I think this is really the centerpiece, Moses speaking with the Lord on the mountain. There's so many sacred symbolisms and other things and things that just as we ponder it and as we study it. And when I look at the literature, I mean, you know, there are whole books written on this passage where God tells him his name and what that means and what that stands for.
Oh, yeah.
And how important it is. And you know, I think we often take it for granted because of Latter-day Revelation that we have a little bit of a different understanding of where that fits in the big picture and some of the temple ramifications and other things about that go on. But I can't help but think that this coming week, while we're studying this is an area that we should be paying special attention to.
Well, another reason to pay attention to it is I think it's been a year, but Elder Holland's last book was Witness for His Names,
mm-hmm.
where he looks at the names.
Yeah, yeah, he just came out with all the names in the scriptures.
And he just, I don't know if it's exhaustive. But it is insightful.
Well, and Dallin Oaks has done that too. There's two. He's only written a couple of books. Dallin hasn't written very many books. President Oaks hasn't. But one of the first ones, was his holy name.
Yeah.
And that was the first conference talk he gave as an apostle, way back in 1984 and 85.
I thought that was why do we serve? But I would think that was the one right after that.
Maybe it was.
But the fact that you've got two senior apostles who think this is important,
mm-hmm.
Is, I think, ample justification for taking this revelation of the name.
Well, and when you look at it in the Septuagint, in the Greek version, this is the one that sends everybody crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Jesus uses it in the New Testament. I mean, you have this phrase in that, and they just go nuts.
Yeah, this is when Jesus uses that phrase in John. Chapter 8,
yes.
If I remember right, then, yeah, they want to stone him because mm-hmm. they think that's an inappropriate use of the name of God.
One final thing, John, we're going to move on, but in Chapter 6, Moses and Aaron ask Pharaoh for permission to go and worship. They don't ask for freedom. They just ask for a temporary release, like a pilgrimage or something, to go out in the wilderness and celebrate a festival, if you will, or to worship God. And then Pharaoh digs in his heels, and ultimately that leads to the slavery. I'm just kind of curious, what would have happened if Pharaoh said, sure, just come on back? I mean, you know, maybe that's a what if.
Well, let's consider a modern example. Freiburg, Germany, in the temple.
Mm-hmm.
And at first it was a patriarch or a stake leader getting permission to go to Switzerland and finally to go on a yearly basis. And they said, well, why don't you just build one here?
Mm-hmm.
And that helped, I think, lead to the freedom in East Germany. Even if, in their case, they did relent and said, yeah, you can.
Well, eventually it needed to happen, but it was a longer process that the Lord took. But I, in fact, I just was reading stories about the Freiburg Temple and people who went there just 2 days ago. So it's interesting that you would bring that up as an example.
Well, it's a great temple. Mm-hmm. But that's a case where the government did say, yes, you can go in. Mm-hmm. And
you go worship. And you come back.
You go and you
maybe
come
they'd
back.
Read Exodus and they thought, Pharaoh should have listened.
I don't know the process, but very grateful for the way things turned out. But, yeah, he digs in his heels and comes out the worse for it. And I think we need to remember that is if you want to go up against the Lord, you want probably don't want to do that.
Yeah, I'd agree. Hey, this is Terry Hutchinson and John Gee signing off from Interpreter Foundation Radio. Thanks for listening to us tonight. Join us next week with Interpreter Foundation for our co-hosts next week. Thanks for listening.